This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world.
Join me in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names and a mystery beyond all naming. This Sunday we are contemplating the world, both the world of this church and the world that surrounds this blue marble of our planet. When we see the devastation of war and the complexities of a world that's supposedly going global in its economics, we're struck by the fact that it seems no matter how many countries we get involved in commerce, it's nearly always the poor and the disenfranchised that suffer. China is moving into the foreground of those countries where jobs are being outsourced, and their factories are surrounded by razor wire and armed guards 24 hours a day. The workers are told that the wire and the guards are there to protect them, but there is a sense in which these wage slaves are being held captive by the simple fact that their children, like all children everywhere, cry when they are hungry. Help us to remember these crying children when we go to places that sell cheap, because the manufacturing has been cheap. Cheap products are one thing, but life itself should never be sold short. And if cheap means suffering for men, women, and children 10,000 miles away, perhaps we should reconsider the purchase. It's inescapable that during this Social Action Sunday that we remember the Serenity Prayer used by so many 12-step groups. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. May the words of our mouths be written on our hearts, and may our hearts lead us to clothe the poor, feed the hungry, give succor to those in need. This morning, too, we remember how blessed we are. Before we complain this week, may we remember that even though we may be in pain, there are roofs over our heads, food on our tables, and hot water in our baths. This we pray in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. I have two readings this morning for this service, and I'm going to paraphrase both of them. The first one is from the Good Doctor's book, Luke, and it's the parable of the great banquet. And basically, it goes like this. There was once a rich man who decided to have a banquet for all his friends, so he sent out invitations around the town, and one by one, the answers came back. One friend said, "Look, I just bought a new car, and I'd like to test drive it, so I'm not going to be at your banquet." And the other one said, "Well, I just married a wife, and she won't let me come, so I can't be at your banquet." And the third one said, "You know, I haven't checked my Palm Pilot today, but I'm sure there's something I've got to do on that day, so I won't be there." Well, the rich man told his servant, "Go out into the town and bring everybody you can to the dinner." And the servant said, "We've done that, sir. There's still plenty of seats left over." "Well, then," he said, "go to the poor places, behind the dumpsters, behind the restaurants, down the alleyways, and bring the homeless in. And if one of my friends showed up that I originally invited, don't let them get a morsel of this feast." The second story is by Lewis Carroll. It's Through the Looking Glass, one of the many stories that Carroll wrote about his niece, Alice. And in the story, she desperately wants to go through the looking glass and get into the looking glass room. And she's talking to her kitty, and she's saying, "Kitty, wouldn't it be wonderful? We could be in the looking glass room, and the most wonderful thing about it is there'd be no adults there." Well, as she's saying this, the mirror gets kind of misty, and she passes through with her cat into the looking glass room, and she's astounded. There's even a fire there, and she's very excited about that because it's a cold winter day, and she knows in the looking glass room she'll still be warm, and best of all, there won't be adults there to shoo her away from the fireplace. Her last words are, "Oh, what fun it'll be. They'll see me through the looking glass here, and they'll not be able to get at me." Both of these stories are parables. They are short, fictitious narratives with morals or spiritual truths. When my daughter Isabel was very little, she used to walk about the house with a rather large mirror, looking into the mirror, stepping over the lintels as she walked into the next room. And I had to realize as I was writing this sermon that my daughter didn't exactly pass through the looking glass, but she was using the looking glass to create a world that wasn't occupied and where all the rules weren't made up by the adults. She had turned the adult world upside down. The floor was now the ceiling, and the ceiling was now the floor. It must be gratifying for children to turn the adult's world upside down, inside out, to take that which they do not completely understand, a world which they have not made the rules for, do not control, and flip it so that the new world, the one they have created, is known only to them, and they are the only ones to know that it's proper to step around the light fixture on the ceiling. As Alice would have put it, "Oh, what fun it'll be. They'll see me in the looking glass room, but not be able to get to me." Today, we will be turning worlds inside out and upside down so that we might glimpse through a rearrangement of life the possibilities that have escaped us. Escaped us because we've grown too accustomed to the manner in which our world is arranged. So accustomed, in fact, that we now take this arrangement to be the status quo or the state in which everything has always been. Today, as I said, is Social Action Sunday, and that doesn't mean we're going to take to the streets with bullhorns and banners, but it also doesn't mean that you get to drop just one extra can of tuna in the Caritas box. It's interesting to say the least that during times of great boon in this country, during times of prosperity, charitable giving goes down dramatically. In fact, charitable giving per capita was the greatest during the Depression, during the 30s. So, as we get older and we keep going downhill, maybe we'll get to see charitable giving go up again. There's an analogy going around in churches. The analogy is that a church either has windows in which they can look out on the world and see what needs to be done, or they have mirrors which reflect the congregation and the parishioners, mainly so they can focus on the needs of the congregation itself. We do have windows in this church, but it looks out on a rather peaceful garden with a gurgling fountain, and it isn't much like the real world. It has also been said that social action is the true measure of any congregation. Based on our social action agenda here at this church, what grade do you think we deserve? In a recent newsletter I got from First Church Dallas, which is my home church, there were two items in the newsletter that were bracketed away from the rest of the newsletter. And the first one, it goes like this. Quote, "The power of commitment. First Church Dallas raised $138,952 in 2005 to aid the survivors of Katrina, Rita, and the Asian tsunami." In the other box, it proclaimed, "The power of commitment. First Church Dallas inspired over 100 volunteers to adopt 21 families during the Katrina evacuation." Yes, First Church Dallas is larger than we are. They have 1,067 members. But it isn't the number of members that counts. It's the level of commitment. In any congregation, the level of commitment that will, the people that will actually go out and get their hands dirty is about 10%. So what are the benefits of being in a socially active church? When I was at First Church, First Presbyterian Church in Dallas, yes, I've moved around quite a bit, as have all of you, to end up here. I was with a group of 35 or 40 people who went down to Ciudad Juarez to help build a home for a family down there. We stayed at a community center that had been built down there at a sister Presbyterian church by monies from all over Texas and churches all over Texas. And the accommodations were minimal, to say the least. We lived in dormitories-type rooms. All the men dormed together. There were bunk beds. There were shared bathrooms. Same with the women. The greatest thing, though, was we paid a Mexican woman to go out and buy the food and cook Mexican for us all week long. And although we enjoyed the meals much, we suffered much also. The funny thing was, the projects varied that we did, but the very first project that we did was we built a home for this family, a man, a woman, two daughters, and a son. And to say home in this country isn't exactly right, because it was basically 40 by 40 square feet. The first it had was going to have two sleeping rooms, not really bedrooms, and a kitchen that was divided from a very small living room. The first time we gathered in a circle and prayed. The father wasn't there because he had to be at work. And we dedicated our project and our work to the greater glory of God. You can think what you like about that. The point is, we were conscious and we were making a deliberative choice about what we were doing. We built the home in less than 4 days, and then the majority of workers went on to other projects, but the real skilled laborers, the carpenters and the electricians, stayed to finish out the inside of the home. At the end of the week, we gathered once again, and this time the father was there. We circled the house holding hands, and we prayed once again, and we planted a tree in hopes that this family would begin to grow and prosper as this tree would grow. And I don't think there was a dry eye in the place. The point is, it wasn't about the Mexican couple. It wasn't about that family. I mean, yes, we built them a place to live. It had running water. It had electricity. There were no bathrooms. They were communal outhouses in this particular community. But we didn't really know what had happened to us until we came back after that week, the first morning in Dallas at the First Presbyterian Church, when we were asked to sit down front. And Dr. Carl, the senior pastor of that church, asked us to stand up, and 1,200 people rose to their feet and gave us a standing ovation for our work, because we were the 10% who were willing to go out and get our hands dirty. And yet, even though we put together the resources necessary for such a project to happen, and even though we were recognized by the congregation itself, the true benefit of this work didn't come about until the weeks after that, when we saw those people in the hallway. It wasn't just, hey, how you doing? It was, we stopped, we hugged, we had been together, lived together, been sick together. We inquired into their lives and how they were doing. We had gone down to Mexico to help build up their community, but in truth, it was our community that was built up. There's a short story by the French existentialist Albert Camus. It's called The Artist at Work. In this short story, there is a man called Jonas, who is named after Jonah of the Jonah and the whale story. Camus loved to take biblical stories and turn them upside down. In this story, Jonas believes in his star. He works for his father in a publishing business, but then gets interested in painting, and he starts painting. And then the world's critics, the art critics, are vying for the chance to say, "We discovered Jonas. He's a great painter." Well, Jonas got swallowed by his fame, just as Jonah got swallowed by the whale. And he didn't have very good boundaries, and so the people came to his house, and he let them in, and they had dinner, and they had breakfast, and they stayed the night. And pretty soon, Jonas didn't have any place to paint. But he had a very large living room, and in the corner of that living room, he built a loft, just big enough for him to get up there and paint. So as the party went on underneath him day and night, as people drank up his money from his paintings, Jonas sat up there and painted and didn't even come down for his meals. And then one day he collapsed and fell from the loft. And this is what it says in the last few paragraphs. "It's nothing," the doctor said, who was called to see about Jonas. "He's working much too hard. In a week, he'll be on his feet again." "You sure he'll get well?" Louise, his wife, asked with a distorted face. "Oh, yes," the doctor said, "he will get well." In the other room, his old friend Rateau was looking at the painting that Jonas had been working on for 3 months. It was completely blank except for one small word in the middle of the painting. And Rateau couldn't make out exactly what that word was. It either was solitary or solidary. Solitary as in solitude, or solidary as in solidarity. It suggested in the article that I read about churches that a church either have windows or mirrors. But I'm saying to you today that a real church, a church like this, needs to have windows and mirrors. We need to be able to look out on the world and see what needs to be done, but we need to be self-reflective about the social action work that we're doing. A church that has only mirrors would obviously be a social club, and the money that they would be raising would be for a golf course and a clubhouse. Real churches, like real people, use both mirrors and windows. We must reach out to the world at large, but we also must be self-reflective. You know, during the late 19th century and early 20th century, white people basically did social action work because it was the noblesse oblige. It was the noble obligation. We're going to go out there, we're going to help these poor people because obviously they don't have as good a culture as we do. It was social Darwinism in action. Yet to be too self-reflective while we're working would be what happened to Alice when she got into the looking glass room. What did she discover? Everything is backwards. Everything. There's a story that's told about a off-Broadway revival of the Anne Frank story. And, you know, if this play is done right, my goodness, the sympathy that comes for the Jews during the Holocaust. But there were troubles with this production, especially with the actress who was playing Anne. She simply wasn't up to snuff. When the Gestapo showed up at the house where Anne was hiding, someone in the balcony yelled out, "She's in the attic!" They just wanted that play to be over. Let's not be a church that when we do social action work, the people that we're helping are saying in the back of their minds, it's about them, it's not about us. It's a mirror, they're looking at themselves, do good. The banquet alluded to in the Lucan passage this morning is the banquet that we partake of every day. We have bread on our table, it's salted, we have our soup, we have our delicious meals. But if we don't share this, the bread will lose its salt, the soup will lose its taste, and we will essentially be excluded from the banquet. On this Social Action Sunday, let us covenant together that we will be a church that has both windows and mirrors. Let us covenant together to reach out to those in need. That we will write that extra large check when disasters happen, that we will investigate our motives and our intentions so that as a caring, loving, and responsible, sentient being church, we can be proud of the action this church takes in the world and equally proud of the reflection that that church makes in the world.